Session number 10123.
Mr. Watney, Reel 2. You were saying that he was running...
He was running the military side of the Socialist Party resistance group in the southwest of France. And the group was called the Group Veni, V-E-N-Y. And the Veni was a code name given because the person who was running the socialist resistance in France was General Vincent. But General Vincent had retired, and he was getting rather old for the position. Now, the Socialist Party had four groups in the south of France. That means the south of France, I mean of unoccupied France, which one was in Lyon, one was in Marseille, one was in Toulouse, and one was in Limoges. And so we asked for more agents to be sent down because those four areas were too far apart for us to manage from one place. And the War Office agreed, but we had to state very rapidly, because we heard the first week after landing, that the Socialist Party in Lyon had been taken by the Gestapo. And so we really had to cancel the Lyon resistance group. They then sent down some agents for Marseille, three agents for Marseille, and they came to Saint-Céry. They came and landed at the same area that I'd landed in, which was on the Cos de Grama, near Saint-Céry.
These are the limestone areas, aren't
they? Yes, it is in the limestone cliffs, fairly high. And so they came and they went off to Marseille. And then a short while afterwards, about a matter of fortnight afterwards, they sent down two brothers, the Myers brothers, and their radio operator was a girl called Paddy O'Sullivan. She was a girl who was very Irish and had trained with me at Tame Radio. And they went off to the Limoges area. And after getting in the Limoges area, I was in a hut doing in the back of a cafe doing a transmission to War Office when Paddy O'Sullivan arrived on a motorcycle to say that her radio had broken down and she didn't know how to make it work. I said, oh, well, I said, look, the aerial, all you do is to just hang an aerial up on that hook. Send a message to War Office and see what strength they hear you. And they replied that they heard me radio 5, which is the top signal. So that little aerial was good enough. It was just that little bit of wire hanging up the wall. But then she said, now what do you do? And I said, oh, she said, I'd forgotten doing doubling the frequency, because if you transmit on one of the tapes, you can be heard by the Germans nearby. But if you do if you half your frequency, the signal goes up to the heaviside layer, which lies between the atmosphere and the stratosphere, and is then sent down again by a corresponding angle so that it falls to be heard in the London area, but the Germans cannot direction find you. They can direction find you from a distance of up to about 50 kilometers, but afterwards they can't hear you at all. And so anyway, she was delighted that she'd forgotten how to change the frequencies, and she left and went back to Limoges and went on with the Mars to do the Limoges actions.
When you landed in France, did you have a cover identity and false name and so on?
Yes, I'd chosen my name similar to Harry Pullivy, strangely, because Harry Pullivy was... Pullivy sounded a French name, finishing with an E, acute accent, for an Englishman. So I called myself in France Michel André Pontlevy. And so it was corresponding to Pullivy, but Pontlevy absinthe. And I had my false identity card in that name, and my all my papers in that name. But really, when we were at the Verlax at the farm after landing, we spoke with Harry Pullivy about what action there was in sabotage in the area, and he spoke to us of the there's a factory, a large factory outside Figeac in France, which was called the Ratier factory. And the Ratier factory was a factory which made independent air screws for the propellers of the German fighters, by which they, on takeoff, they could alter the angle of the propeller, and with that gave them, when they were fighting against Spitfires, they could alter the angle of the air taking of the propellers of their planes, and that gave them faster speed in the Focke-Wulf 190 than the Spitfires. And if one could get that factory and blow them up, it would pack up the Focke-Wulf thing. So we then, with George Hiller, we made explosives, plastic explosives, and set them with time signals. Then found that there was... then we had to find out a person who was really up in engines, in factories. And he was kept a motorcycle shop. And he said he would come in with us and... he knew where to place the explosives so as to kind of completely ruin that particular machine. And so he would go. Then we got somebody to drive him, which was a driver there. And there was one other person. And they went off with the explosives, but we hadn't realized. We knew that the sentries outside Ratchet's factory stopped at 6 o'clock, and that the night sentries only came on at 6:30. As it was winter, they went there in the dark at 6 o'clock, and the only person who was guarding the factory was a Frenchman who was suffering from a bad go of flu. And he let them in. They set their explosives at the correct places. They left a 30-minute time fuse on each one of them, set them off, got in the car, went a little along the road and then asked for the direction of Carol from different people, took the road for Carol and then turned off right and came back to Saint-Céry. But of course the factory went off with a large explosion and was written off for the rest of the war. So there were no more variable pitch propellers made for the German army after Atis was blown up.
Were there any other spectacular acts of sabotage at that time?
Well, at that time they were naturally trying to blow up trains and the main railway lines. The main railway lines were running from Toulouse to Paris. The main line was very heavily guarded by the Germans, but next door, running parallel to it, was a line which was kept for goods and which was ready for moving German goods to the Paris area. Well, then I went many times with Jean Verlac, and we put explosives on the lines, on the railway lines, and then stood nearby and blew them up after a locomotive had gone over them. Then we realized that the best thing to do was to go to and find a bridge, a bridge over the river, Dordogne, because when a railway was blown off the track, the way that the Germans repaired it was to send along a locomotive with a crane, which lifted up the locomotive and put it back on the rails, which they'd redone, and that was the train went off. But if you blew up the train on one of these metal bridges over the river, the train went into the river. The locomotive went into the river. When the Germans tried to bring along their
crane,
of course the crane couldn't do anything in a kind of tunnel. And so then it meant a matter of 6 weeks to a couple of months before they can get the train taken to pieces and got off out of the tunnel. And so it was blocked up for a long, long while. And I wanted to do that on the main line, the Toulouse-Paris main line. And we went, we'd got a friend who was in the railways at Martel. The place is Saint-Denis. The railway station of Martel is Saint-Denis. And at Saint-Denis they did the repairs of locomotives. And there was a circular thing on with rails on it. And the locomotives arrived and the circular thing went round and they went off on one line to get in to be repaired. So we thought there was one thing was to get a train onto a line for Paris and to warm it up, which we did without the Germans realizing it, that we were warming a train. One had to warm the train for about 2 hours or so before one could go. And they warmed up a train there, and chap drove it off. We'd laid our explosives on the bridge. And then, of course, after the train had gone, we got a friend to put an explosives on the turnstile on which the locomotives are repaired. So that was blown. Then we blew the train under the bridge. So that rather blocked up that railway line for quite a long time. It was just about that time I was in near a farm near Saint-Céré, and somebody came to me to say that Jacques Poirier, that Harry Pillevy had been taken by the Gestapo in Brive-la-Gaillarde, and he'd been taken to prison. And when he'd gone off to prison, Jacques Poirier had arrived, and he'd asked to go to the Alps where his parents were to see them before he came back and worked with Harry Pillevy. So I realized that the Gestapo were at Harry Pillevy's headquarters waiting for Jacques. So I radioed the War Office to send a message out in the evening that I called Jacques Poirier by a nickname, Gugust, to use the name and say Gugust must not go back to Harry's, but must see Michel first. And that message was sent out, and Jacques Poirier happened to hear it on the radio just before leaving. So he came to me at my farm, and I told him what had happened. Then he kind of had to reorganize that Corrèze resistance line. But of course, Harry Pillevy was the radio operator. So I said, all right, I'd act as radio operator for Jacques Poirier as well as for George Hiller. So I did radio operator for Jacques Poirier until he got a radio operator called Beauclair. He came down about 2 months afterwards and took over the radio contacts from Corrèze.
Were there any rival resistance groups in your area?
Yes, there was the FTP, the Front Tireur et Partisan Français, that's a communist group. They were not, they were well directed by a group of three people. Run by three people, but they didn't have much in the way of arms or weapons or ammunition or explosives even. And so when we had parachutings, they used to try and get to know it by their intelligence ways, and then they would try and attack our people going up to the place where the planes were going to drop parachutes and pinch from our group all the explosives and weapons which were dropped to us.
When you say attack them, in what way?
Well, they used to go and take them prisoner and take them away and keep them in their resistance until the parachuting had taken place, and then let them free to go back to their places. But I realized what was happening, and I had one parachuting coming down, and I thought I'd go off with two friends of mine and arrive there after the communists and try and take it back. While we were on our way there, there were cliffs on the side, and they did drop very large rocks, but they missed the car, thank heavens. We got up there. We stopped. We got there without the engine on, and we walked along there. I saw a car, and went up to it very slowly and saw one of the heads of the communist group asleep at the steering wheel. So I put my revolver close to him and snatched his revolver away, in which he woke up, and I told him that if he moved, we'd shoot him, we'd kill him. I told him to stay in the car, and we were going to collect the people who were trying to get the parachuting. And he didn't get out of the car, because he did try, and a shot went off straight away. And so he didn't try and get out of his car. And when we'd got received our parachuting there, we got them off all right. And I told him that he must never come back and try and pinch our parachutings again. And I said that's the last time we wanted them to come and ever try and steal at our resistance group. And naturally, he was another resistance group.
Did they try it again?
No, they didn't try it again. He was taught a lesson in that way, and he never tried again.
How soon after you had landed was that, approximately?
Oh, I would say it was about 4 months after.
I think you had made some contingency plan in case you were captured and tortured.
Yes, I had agreed with Harry Bolivie and George Hiller that if one was taken and tortured, not to in any way keep things away from the Germans who were torturing. Just tell the truth about things. And the agents who were not taken would know about the person being taken and would then look after themselves so that they were not caught by the Germans. Well, naturally, after Harry Bolivie was taken, he did mention that I was using a radio in the area, but he didn't know where I was. I went off in a van down to Figeac to go into a completely different area of the Lot. And I went out to a farm near Figeac to put my radio station. Well, I went to Figeac and stopped. I was going to stop the night at a flat of a teacher in Figeac school, a woman teacher, who lived in a flat there, and she was also in the resistance group. And so I stayed there, and at about 5 o'clock in the morning, her daughter, Pierrette, who was 5 years old, came in and said, the Gestapo are here. They're in the road. And so the Gestapo came to the door. She opened the door, and they said, is this number 7? And she said, there are no numbers in this road. We haven't got any numbers. You have to go to the end of the road and count the houses. The road was quite long, and she came back and told me and other person, and we went off, put her in a pushchair, and hid the radio under the coal bin in the cellar, under the coal in the cellar. We got the pushchair and took her off, and we walked through the Gestapo because they'd gone up to the other end of the road. And we walked through the Gestapo, went on, and found another house, which was run by a woman, Marie, who looked after... it was as a residence for the women school teachers in Figeac. Well, I arrived there and was very pro-English. She gave me a very good meal, and while I was eating the meal, the Gestapo arrived there. So I got up and stood behind the front door. Then, happily, I was remembering certain of the tricks that they told me in Scotland. I was breathing through my mouth, because if you breathe through your nose, of course, the sound of the valves in your nose indicates that somebody's there. And I stood at the back of the front door while she opened the front door. And she refused to the Germans that they couldn't come into her house because it was only for school teachers, and she would never allow a man through her threshold. No man could ever come in through her threshold, and she was a very strong-willed person. She must have been 80 years old, but she was very strong-willed, and she talked the Germans from coming into her house at all.
What would you have done if they had come?
I don't know what I would have done. I didn't know. I had my automatic, but I didn't know what. One would have seen what would have happened. But so they went off, and then a friend came with his van with a on which was working on a motor running by Brook Gazo, by charcoal, and he said he'd take me off to a farm outside Figeac, where we went off, and of course they just shot three Frenchmen who apparently looked like me on the road to the village. But when I got there, it was quite deserted, and I found that it was quite an easy place to transmit from there. So I transmitted from there for about a month. Then moved on to another place. But you see, one thing which was of vast importance was that a radio, a B2 radio, which is what we all had, were fairly large suitcases, and the Germans knew what the suitcases looked like.